Hey, what up? This is Dart Adams, and this is episode 88 of Dart Against Humanity. I decided to do this episode because every sign was pointing to it, and when everything seems to be pointing to something, you shouldn't avoid it. You should just go towards it. I've done a million Zoom calls, Skype calls, and interviews over the past, today's the 23rd, so the past 3+ weeks. Back to back in succession. And recently, a lot of my calls, interviews, phoners, discussions I've had all had to do or all pointed in some way to Black and Latino erasure in Boston. I did an article. I was interviewed for an article by Dasha Moore in the Boston Globe, and it was about different things being renamed and put up in Boston and how I felt about it. I said a lot of it seemed performative and some of it was cosmetic, and I'm going to judge things on their long-lasting change and the commitment to doing it. One of the things that happened is there's been a monument that's drove me insane my entire life, pretty much since I've been a conscious human being. I live in the South End, Lower Roxbury. I now live even closer to it. I live on Columbus Ave, which is a laugher in and of itself, and in a Park Plaza section of Boston, which is less than a 5-minute walk from me, there is a statue of Abraham Lincoln, and it's about emancipation. I didn't know that there were two of these statues in the nation, and the first one is in Washington, D.C., and Boston somehow got the second one. I don't know why. And then I also found out something I didn't know is that there had been a history of people wanting it gone. And someone who's a local politician, a Black politician, actually defended it, saying that, you know, Black freed people actually raised the money for it to be erected. And I've hated it my entire life. It's a picture of Abraham Lincoln and a slave or a Black person on their knees. And he's like, has his hand over him like he's emancipating them. My contention is that this monument never should have existed in Boston, because what happened in Boston is between 1773 and 1783, a bunch of freed Black people and some who were slaves petitioned the courts, and the Massachusetts legislature, for them to be freed, they put in a freedom petition. Paul Cuff wrote a whole bunch of things about representation and taxation, and ultimately got made it so that Black men, because Black women weren't allowed to do anything, women weren't allowed to vote, were the first people that weren't white in the entire nation to be able to serve on a jury. That was 1780. And then we had two different people that were slaves at the time sue their owners / masters in court for abuse and sue for their freedom. They both won. Quok Walker and Elizabeth Freeman, I believe their names were. And after they sued and were freed, they both sued for reparations. Okay? And after all these different wins kept happening through the legal system, in 1783, after 10 years of just Black folks just going ham on the legal system and making advancements, Massachusetts just said, fuck it, we're just going to abolish slavery. So they abolished slavery in 1783. And my contention has always been that all the people that were instrumental in that happening between 1773 and 1783 should have a monument instead of Lincoln, because that's the emancipation thing that happened, that emancipation went into was signed in 1865. And then it didn't really go into effect until now there's Juneteenth. But 82 years before that, Boston's Black folks fought for their own freedom before pretty much anybody else in the colonies / country. That's what we should be celebrating. But we're not. And when I said this to Dasha, she was like, what? Like, this happened for real? And I'm like, yeah. It's like, I didn't know that. Thing is, very few people know that. There are people that know it in Boston, but very few people know it outside of Boston. Why? Because black contributions or black achievements by Bostonians or Massachusetts residents are largely erased from history. Because Boston does not embrace black or Latino contributions at all. When you think about Boston, the face of Boston is always white. The lens through which it's portrayed is always white. And this is incredibly frustrating for someone like me. Now, after I did that interview about 15 minutes before I picked up the phone and did the interview with Dome Theory Podcast. And he asked me about it. And I told him what it was. And then we started talking about black erasure in Boston. And I went in on this fact that the reason black people who are from Boston have this stigma or have the or get abuse from black and Latinos outside of the city or nationwide is because their view of Boston is overly white. And what that does is, one, it presents the idea that Boston is a super white city and we don't exist. Because the image of Boston being very unfriendly towards anyone, any non-white group is prevalent. And the only way to combat that is if there were some different stories or different narratives out there to show life, Boston life through non-white eyes. And the thing is that when you think of celebrities from Boston, if I was to ask you to name me five non-white Bostonian celebrities, a lot of people would be hard pressed, or non-white celebrities from Massachusetts, they'd be hard pressed to do it. Whereas someone from Boston could rattle off a list like nothing. They'd be like Uzo Aduba. They say Diane Guerrero. They say Brian White. They say Pooch Hall, Michael Beach. You know, and like the list will go on and on. If you're talking about like the internet, you got people like Rito Brown, you know, Sam Jones III. It would just, and you just keep going. Like, you think about people on the radio. There's Cherry Martinez. There's Maya DeBee. But the thing is, if you're not from here, you don't know that. If you're not from here, you don't know that Jasmine Solano started her radio career here. Or if you're not from here, you weren't listening to WRBB and Kiss 108 in the mid-80s and know that Wendy Williams started her radio career here. Because black contributions to Boston are largely erased. I'm sitting in an apartment again where Ron McNair lived when he taught martial arts in the South End, Lower Roxbury, and went to school at MIT and played jazz in local area clubs like Wally's. These are things we know because we were told and we lived here, but nobody outside of it knows. I further made the example that when I would go online looking up things like the Rainbow Coalition and it lists all the Rainbow Coalition offices, there's no mention of the Rainbow Coalition office in Boston, which is odd because it was one of the first Rainbow Coalition offices. Why? Because one of the earliest contributors to the Rainbow Coalition, going back to the Project Breadbasket days and Operation Push, was Mel King, who was friends with Martin Luther King Jr. while he was a student at BU getting his doctorate. And when he met Coretta Scott King, they met in my neighborhood, dated in my neighborhood. Believe at one point they both lived on Mass Ave. One had an apartment on Mass Ave, one had an apartment further down on Mass Ave, in a place that should be a museum. And me and B. John Bain talk about this all the time. This place should have been preserved. It should be a museum. And everybody, and it is a testament to black history and our contributions in Boston. I give tours in this neighborhood, and when I tell these kids, they go to a school called the Commonwealth School, and when I tell them all of the things that are contained just in this small area, they are in shock that everybody doesn't know about it. Again, I grew up in South and Lower Roxbury on Mass Ave between Columbus Ave and Tremont. Now, the thing about that is that growing up, I was always told these stories about Martin Luther King Jr., about Quincy Jones, who lived on Pembroke Street when he went to the Schillinger School, which is now known as Berklee College of Music. I was told stories about Miles Davis hanging out with certain people. People had Miles Davis stories. And these people had so many stories that I thought they're just pulling my leg and telling the little kid lies just to get me going. They told me about Sammy Davis Jr. growing up in different buildings all on Columbus Ave and off of it. They tell me about different jazz musicians like Count Basie or Cab Calloway and Cab Calloway's big sister, Blanche. And like they just tell me all these stories of black musicians and James Brown saving Boston from burning down. And I'm just like, what? Like, y'all just making stuff up. Because if there was all this black history in Boston, then this would be in every book. And nobody ever talks about Boston in that way. They talk about Harlem. They talk about Chicago. They talk about Detroit. They talk about, like, Mississippi. They talk about New Orleans as these places of rich, vibrant black history. But never Boston, Harlem. And then I find out that a lot of it has to do with, you know, PR. Who's framing the history? Who's telling the story? And erasure, which I didn't know was a word. Like, I grow up learning that America's relationship with Puerto Rico starts probably like 1898. And the early emissaries between the U.S. and Puerto Rico were from Boston. The first people to move from Puerto Rico to Boston happened between the 1910s and the 1920s, early on. And then enough Puerto Ricans began moving to Boston, but when they moved, they usually moved to the same place, Southend and Lower Roxbury, then later into Roxbury. By the time we get to the 40s and 50s, the black population and Latino population starts to climb slowly. But they're concentrated in the South End, Lower Roxbury. This is where I live. And then once we get to the 60s and 70s, the population explodes. And they are diverted to, say it with me, South End, Lower Roxbury, into Roxbury, then into Dorchester. And then later on, out into different parts of Massachusetts, different country, different cities and towns of Massachusetts, to the point where now there are multiple towns in Massachusetts that are majority Latino. When people think East Boston, they think Latinos. You know, there are different towns where the population is so heavily Latino that people kind of write those towns off, which is insane to think. Places like Brockton got tagged as being scary or unsafe. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's a heavy population of brown people living there. There's this double talk about Dorchester being unsafe or dangerous. And I went back and checked. And when did this start? It starts when the population gets browner and browner. And the reason people leave out Roxbury, or every time there's something violent that happens on the news, or someone gets shot and you see Roxbury in there immediately, is largely because it has a connotation of being black following the white flight in the 60s and slightly before that. In the 70s going forward, Roxbury is left to the black and Latino populations. And it's said that during that time, this is when economic disparity really occurs. I discovered, again, between 1959 and 1970, We used to have, before that time, there were a whole bunch of places with full liquor licenses and entertainment licenses in the South End, Lower Roxbury, into Roxbury neighborhoods. We're talking venues that can play music, sell liquor, sell food. Between 1959 and 1970, pretty much all of them are shut down or burned down, besides one. And that one ends up being Wally's, which moves across the street where it was Wally's Paradise, and now it's just Wally's Jazz Club. And the BRA, Boston Redevelopment Association, following 1968-69, people start petitioning for new spaces. One of the places that got a spot was Bob DeChef's. Now, Bob was working in one of these area jazz clubs that got shut down along Mass Ave, and him and his wife used to cook in the kitchen and sell food to people, and they came up with this thing called glorified chicken. Glorified chicken. And it was so popular that people were like, yo, when y'all gonna open up a spot? So they opened up a spot on, say it with me, Columbus Ave. Now, mind you, when I was a kid, my very first bus stop was directly across the street from Bob DeChef's. And my second bus stop was down the street from it. It was on the corner. My bus stop was on the other corner on the same side of the street. So Black Boston has always been something that was embedded in me. I grew up, again, on Mass Ave. My block, the corner, there's Tremont Street. There's the one bus stop. And the hospital I was born in was Boston City Hospital. I could see it right out my window. If I walk down the street, the beginning of the block, on that corner is the NAACP building. The same NAACP building where Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta used to meet and everybody used to do their organizing. That small building on that corner. If you go there now, you don't know what that building is. It's repainted, refurbished, painted up. It has a huge fence on it. There's no plaque denoting what it is. The only people that know what it is are people that used to live in that neighborhood. And I got to tell you, pretty much nobody who lives there now was living there in the 80s when it was actually an active office. Which is sad, but gentrification. And Boston is one of the most heavily gentrified cities. I think it's top three. And it's slightly behind San Francisco, to give you an idea how scary that sounds. But growing up, we were also told in a sense that nobody wants to hear about Boston, because when they think Boston, they don't think Black. So kind of keep it quiet. When New Edition were kids and they got signed, they were first signed to Streetwise, right? So yeah, in their videos, if you look at their videos, they're wearing Boston stuff. They got Boston hats. They're dancing in Boston. Candy Girl is all along my neighborhood, South End, Lower Roxbury, and the Back Bay, which is also connected right to those cities, right to those places. Candy Girl starts at the front of a train station, the L, that was torn down in 1987. One of the diners that was right along that street, which no longer exists in Roxbury, they walked down to Commonwealth Avenue Mall, which is right in the Back Bay, which is right next to South End, Lower Roxbury. They're at the Hat Shell, which is on the Charles River, which is in walking distance of it. They're in front of the new John Hancock building, which is right there near Copley Square, which is right in my neighborhood around the corner from me. So when you look at their video, and then they did the Popcorn Love video is in Orchard Park. So early on, they couldn't avoid being Boston. But when you think Boston, you do not think Black, which is sad. Because the man who's the father of the Harlem Renaissance was living in Boston and Cambridge for years, came up with the idea for what the Harlem Renaissance is largely, because of living in and experiencing Roxbury, the South End, and Beacon Hill, which was rich with Black history. The African Meeting Church, the Black History Museum, all these things are early indicators of like Boston's Black experience and its influence. If you go back to history and the Black experience in America, you have to start with Boston. The first sizable settlement of Black people, especially freed Black people, goes back to the 1650s in Boston's North End, a place called either Little Guinea or New Guinea. And it was in the North End. It was by the waterfront. People could work by the water, and also they could work as tradespeople right there in the North End. That population later migrated and moved to Beacon Hill, which later moved again into Roxbury and the South End, and then later into Dorchester. And the Great Migration led even more people from the South into Boston's Back Bay, Lower Roxbury, Roxbury, Dorchester, later Mattapan too. The sad part is that we're so erased to the point where whenever the idea of anything Boston comes up, the whiteness of Boston is immediately used as a selling point. And at the same time, any brown people who live in Boston are automatically erased. Case in point, if we look at sports events, it's always the culture team versus a Boston team. And everybody in the culture, meaning the mass of Black and Latino in America, pull for the culture team. So I've always experienced being a very brown person who loves the Celtics. I'm looking at a Celtics long sleeve black shirt that's by Adidas, because I don't wear anything Nike, that my sister went through pain to try to find because she knows I only wear Adidas Celtics gear. Now you're looking at all of the Black and Latino Celtics, Patriots, Red Sox fans against everybody else. And we always get shit on. Why? We catch strays. Why? Because we don't exist in their minds. Because all Boston is white people. Forget the reality of Boston. When I was a kid growing up, my first year in the Boston public school system was 79-80. So between 79-80 and I say 84-85, I was in kindergarten 1 to 4th grade. By the time I get to 5th grade, there are barely any white kids remaining in my classroom. Okay? By the time I get to 6th grade, which is the 86-87 school year at the James P. Timothy in Roxbury, on Roxbury Street, the heart of Black Boston, there are so few Black kids there that the ones that are there aren't even bused anymore because they couldn't get enough kids on the bus because their parents wouldn't agree to send them. They had to take public transportation and the brand new Orange Line, which was built as they tore down the elevated train line, which ran through the Black part and Latino part of Boston. There was a train that used to go straight through Dudley Square, which is now Nubian Square. It's gone. The economic power that was in the South End, Lower Roxbury, and Roxbury was pretty much erased. When I told you between 1959 and 1970 that all of those places with full liquor licenses and entertainment licenses either burned down or were shut down, and they were left with one, all that economic power disappeared from that neighborhood. And also, there was a time when if you wanted to go shopping, You could just go to Dudley Square. You didn't have to go to Downtown Crossing. In that same amount of time, all the economic power was stripped from Dudley Square and removed to Downtown Crossing. Now, for someone like me who grew up in the South End of Little Roxbury, Dudley Square is a 20, 25-minute walk from where I live. However, Downtown Crossing is a 10 to 15-minute walk from my neighborhood. So it didn't affect me that much, but let's say I lived in Dorchester. Let's say I lived in Mattapan. What's closer? Dudley Square is far closer than Downtown Crossing. I just happen to be near everything. In my neighborhood, that makes me equidistant from Fenway Park, which is a place we didn't go when I was a kid because it was hostile to black people. And also Boston Garden, which I didn't go to either because it was told to me that the North End was very dangerous for a black kid to go. But I watched them on TV. Now, if we're going to talk about erasure too and how it appears in media, one of the things I talked about was there was a documentary that was done about the Boston Red Sox called The Curse of the Bambino. There was only one black person who was a contributor to it, and that was Howard Bryant. Howard Bryant, who wrote the book Shut Out. A friend of mine, Howard Bryant, one of my favorite journalists. Me reading Shut Out gave me the idea that maybe I could write in this space. I read that book twice, back to back. It just enthralled me, right? Now, he's on screen for about, 90 seconds? And after they did the black thing and got the black shit out the way, they're talking to everybody else. Different kinds of white people. Variety of white people from all over New England. Comedians. Brown-eyed white folks. Blue-eyed white folks. White folks with hazel eyes. Women. Men. White still. Some different backgrounds, different ethnicities. Subsets of ethnic groups within white folks. And they talk about the Red Sox, their experience with the Red Sox. Nary a Latino nor a black person was interviewed, as if we had no fucking experience growing up with the Red Sox. My history with the Red Sox goes back to 1978. That was my first season being a Red Sox fan, and it ended with me learning that I should hate the Yankees because of them losing the one game playoff. I saw that, I believe I was 3 years old when I saw it, and I've hated the Yankees ever since. That would be a great fucking story to tell. All the kids that played at Franklin Field, all the kids that played at what is now Louis Tiant Park, all the kids that played at what's now called James Rice Field in Roxbury, all the kids that played at Carter Playground to play baseball, where my cousin Al used to play as one of the Boston Astros. That would have been very great to include in either The Curse of the Bambino or the second part, Reverse the Curse by HBO, which is interesting because, again, in this part, they shoot whole new interviews with the same crazy spectrum of white folks. And the same piece by Howard Bryant is still there, and brown people only get 90 motherfucking seconds. Moreover, there have been multiple documentaries done about the Celtics and Lakers. One of them that really felt like a slap in the face was Lakers Celtics Best of Enemies. And the perspective or the voiceover is done on one side, I believe, by Ice Cube, and the other side is done by Donnie Wahlberg, not Mark Wahlberg, Donnie Wahlberg. Now, it's interesting because you have Ice Cube doing a narration on one side and Donnie Wahlberg doing a narration on the other side. We could have had Mike Bivens, you know? If you should match it up with something equivalent, you know? Like, you couldn't get anybody black from Boston to do this. No one You couldn't have gotten Howard. You couldn't have got Bijan Bane. And also, the other point is that whenever there's like a game played in Boston on ABC or back in the days on NBC, and they would play regional music, it would always be White Axe. If the Celtics are playing the Philadelphia 76ers, you're going to hear Sweet Emotion by Aerosmith. You're going to hear Freeze Frame by J Geils Band. You know, you're going to hear You Might Think by the Fucking Cars. Or Who's Going to Drive You Home? Some shit like that. Or you might even hear like a Billy Squire song, you know, something like that. You're never going to hear Donna Summer. You're never going to hear New Edition. You're never going to hear Ed O.G. and the Bulldogs, I Gotta Have It. You're sure as hell never going to hear an RSO song. That's not going to happen. But there are other options. When the Patriots played the Eagles in the Super Bowl, on one side you have Will Smith representing the Eagles, and for Boston you have fucking Michael Chiklis. And when you do interviews on ESPN, who represents Boston? Fucking Steve Carell. Steve Carell. And it just goes to show you that when it comes to Boston, we aren't thought of. And if we're not thought of by these outlets, then we're not thought of by our own people. If you ask the average person, name five famous non-white Bostonians or people from Massachusetts, it would be like, do, 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 do. And that is the effectiveness of the erasure. And what that does is it hammers in that we don't exist. And then it hammers in, we can shit on them nonstop because they have no representation. And when you search your memory, hey, wait a minute. I can't name a single fucking neighborhood in Boston that has brown people in it. Therefore, they don't exist. Therefore, they're irrelevant. Therefore, I can feel free to shit on them because there'll be no retribution. So when I first got on the internet and I started writing, first thing I put in my bio, first thing I did in anything was write Bostonian. And I made it very clear I'm brown. I made it very clear I'm black and Latino. And anytime someone had any sideways shit to say about Boston, I was on their ass immediately. Because I had to fight an entire life of erasure and people thinking they could just say and do whatever the fuck they want about my city and my people without anything happening, because we don't exist. We're Smurfs. We're snorks. We're not real. And it took years of me doing this, going at everybody and everything, shutting down anybody who said anything about my city or talked about it without having fucking lived here, set foot here, or maybe spent like, I visited there once. Who gives a fuck? I've lived here for 40 plus years every day. You don't get to speak over me because you don't know what you are talking about. This is my life. This is my lived experience. And it took years of me doing that before other people were like, yeah, because I kind of opened that lane and made it, air quotes, maybe cool to do. You couldn't defend Boston. Because the problem is that being a brown person defending Boston, people immediately think that you're defending all the racism. And I'm not. I am the fucking enemy of that. I go to war with things like, what do you call them? Barstool. I go to war with those dudes. I've been in the streets knocking out bros since the late 80s. I've been choking out bros and racist douchebags with their collars up since the late 80s. I've been living this shit. I've been fighting it. I've been shutting people down since the late 80s, early 90s. as a teenager with a mustache who is 6 feet tall, getting harassed by Boston police. Going back to the Charles Stewart case. The first time I was had a gun pulled on me as a kid because they thought I was a grown-ass man. Because I don't get the same shakes, or I'm not afforded the same things as somebody who's not white. So I grew up in the South End, Lower Roxbury, again, like saying that. It's like fucking Lisa Napoli saying, I bang the blacks. She keeps saying shit over and over again. Or I am a lawyer. So I grew up in the South End. And in the South End in Lower Roxbury, we have Via Victoria. And we have like other neighborhoods like that that people don't know exist. And the history of that neighborhood is crazy because it's on YouTube. There's a whole fucking documentary on YouTube about the creation of this neighborhood. It's insane. And I'm like, yo, like, and the crazy thing to create and to go further into the black erasure, right? I'll be watching something and it's talking about this thing, this black thing that showed that was came out in 1968, came out here in 1968, the first of its kind in 1968. And I'm like, wait. Say Brother was before those. Then I dig deep into why doesn't anybody ever give Say Brother its props as being the first black show of its kind in the nation, predating even Soul Train. And I found out why. Now, Say Brother was created following assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and James Brown being in Boston, and them coming up with the idea to keep people at home to broadcast James Brown's concert at the Boston Garden, which is something local PBS station WGBH just didn't really think to do and didn't have the resources to do. And they hadn't thought of. And they had to do it on short notice. So what they had to do was figure out how to mic up the Boston Garden for a live concert. Figure out how to get the truck and everything else, all the cables there. And then they had to arrange the cameras for a live show, something they had never done. They were going to broadcast it live plus tape it. Now, in the process of doing this, they ran into a whole bunch of community leaders and organizers from Boston's Black and Latino leadership and populations. And they realized, hey, going forward, we're going to have to do some things. We're going to have some shows. We're going to have to do some stuff. And out of it came a show called Say Brother. Say Brother was organized by a man named Topper Carew from Roxbury, who would go on to do, that's me putting a plate in the drawer. Topper Carew, who would go on to write and direct shows like one of the first shows to present a black Boston, a black population in Boston called the Righteous Apples, which aired on PBS in 1980 and 81. Look it up, it's on YouTube. Introduced Boston funk on the low to a wide audience. And also, he was a musician too. Top Cruise musician too. And another guy is a guy who was going to school in Boston at the time named Stan Lathan. One of the greatest things that Stan Lathan created was Say Brother. Another thing was Sanaa Lathan. And Say Brother debuted in 1968. And it embarrassed a bunch of different stations along the East Coast. Because Boston made some black shit strictly for the black population, by the black population first. So what does New York and New Jersey do? They poach the staff from Say Brother as directors, writers of another show that deals as a interview / performance show for black performers, a forum for black performers. It's called Soul, S-O-U apostrophe. So they would do Say Brother, and then they would go to New Jersey and New York and then do that show. Now, mind you, how come everybody knows about Soul, they don't know about Say Brother? Well, here's the thing. Soul had the luxury of being aired everywhere instead of just one area. So if you were on Say Brother in Boston, which is WGBH 2 and 44, and then you get aired in certain places in New England. Whereas Soul was picked up everywhere. So when Soul was writing his tagline, it was like the first show by black folks for black folks, and they used a special word to show that if anybody goes back and checks, we're right. And what it did was it simultaneously erased the existence of Say Brother, because they were using their staff already. All right, keep that in mind. They're using their staff already. They don't air outside of New England. And here we're broadcast everywhere. Now, of course, Soul doesn't last forever. And Say Brother still goes on today, and it's called Basic Black. But when people talk about that, nobody talks about Boston had a show that predates Soul Train, that predates Soul, that predates the other show that I just saw a tweet for today that was a black forum, the first black forum. Like, it was basically political, 1968. They got the idea after seeing Say Brother and Soul. They were like, we need to create another black showcase. Boston started that entire wave. Black Boston started that entire creative wave. We don't get the credit because we've been erased from the conversation entirely. Another thing that really fucking hurt me, hurt my fucking heart. Now, I've grown up with music my entire life. I was immersed in R&B, funk, and soul by being a Boston kid. Boston had its own brand of funk called Boston Funk. Later, people branded it Space Funk. That was our chamber. That was our thing. We did it better than everywhere else. Okay. Between 1979 and I say 1983, 84, the shit took over. Now, a documentary comes out, which is produced by Nelson George. Nelson George calls his documentary Finding the Funk. And I'm excited for this documentary because I know Nelson George wrote liner notes for some of the Boston Funk All-Stars and Boston Funk Groups albums. Not only that, but he covered a lot of these groups when he wrote for Billboard. So I'm like, yeah, I can't wait to see what the Boston lineup and the Boston groups when they do the Boston part of Finding the Funk. And I know Arthur Baker is also a consultant on the show. So I was like, yo, yeah, this is going to be crazy. Boston wasn't mentioned once. Not fucking once. So this means that Arthur Baker and the Johnson crew, who were part of groups, who created and were parts of groups like Glory, North End, Google them if you've never fucking heard of them. No mention of them. There's no mention of the Energetics. No mention of them. No mention of Planet Patrol. They don't exist. No mention of Johnson Crew, the Johnson Brothers or Johnson Crew. They don't exist. I'm just sitting there stunned. Like, how is this possible? Stars Computer Band, they never happened. No mention of New Edition's first album basically being Boston Funk production, never happened. No mention of how Boston Funk pretty much started the timeline of Electro, which blew up in LA, and Latin hip hop / freestyle. Because the guys from Boston used to work in a studio in New York too, and among the many people that worked under them include Shep Pettibone, includes the Latin Rascals, and a guy named Marlon Williams, known as Marley Marl. Marley Marl started sampling because he would watch the Boston Funk guys produce dance music, as he termed it, using samplers like the Fairlight. He found out a way to sample by mistake after being frustrated with seeing what they were doing, because he wanted to use sampling techniques strictly to make rap music. So all this shit gets erased. I did an interview not too long ago with K Fresh on his podcast, Detroit Renaissance. And I was talking about the frustration I had growing up, knowing about all the Boston Funk All-Stars and their contributions to black music and to pop music that go completely unrecognized. Prince Charles Alexander has mentored pretty much everybody, worked with everybody, was a contemporary of Prince's, was big overseas, and was big in the fucking, in Bad Boy blowing up. And one of the engineers is also a guy from Boston. And it's insane because all these people don't get any fucking recognition because they don't exist. Donna Summer being from Boston was never mentioned. When New Edition were young, it seemed like they pretty much made it a point to like, hey, downplay them being from Boston because that's not black. There was a, back in the days, there was a Boston black semi-pro team that played like in the Negro Leagues and below it. They were the Royal Giants, the Boston Royal Giants. But when they toured and played elsewhere, they presented themselves as the Philadelphia Royal Giants. Why? Because no one associated blackness with Boston. So when they went and played elsewhere, they were the Philadelphia Royal Giants. But when they played in New England and whoop everybody's asses, they're the Boston Royal Giants. When they played in Boston, they get to be the Boston Royal Giants. That's fucking insane. But by the same token, the Harlem Globetrotters weren't from Harlem. They were from Chicago. But when you travel and you're black, you present yourself as the Harlem Globetrotters because that represents blackness. How did that happen? PR. Back in the days, the old old movies, anything that was black, you put Harlem on it. Harlem Dandies, Harlem Satin Steppers, Harlem this, Harlem this, or Dixie. It was either Harlem or Dixie. If you go up and down the Back Bay, Lower Roxbury, back in the days, and look at the names of the clubs, something, everything was the Little Dixie, the this, the that, the that, the Harlem this. But the difference being was that musicians from Harlem used to get on the train from Harlem, get off at the Back Bay station, which is right in the Back Bay, South End, Lower Roxbury area, and live in all the different places and the rooming houses and perform at all the jazz clubs in Boston for years. Why? Because back in those days, there was a racist practice called the cabaret card practice, where if you did not own a cabaret card, you couldn't perform in New York. So those Harlem musicians packed this shit up, got on the train, came to Boston and lived life, played in all the clubs, lived it up, made albums, made songs, made 12s, and traveled all around the country from here. There's very few books or anything documenting that. And it's sad because, again, anything about Boston has to do with anything black or Latino is erased. Again, ask anybody or yourself, sit there and name five non-white Boston or Massachusetts celebrities. And then the other thing is that, like, how can there be no representation of Black Boston when you think about Ayanna Presley exists, Marilyn Mosby exists, where they're from, Dorchester and Roxbury, you know? Like, if you go back through history of who did what, they either came here and lived here or from here. When you look at Miles Davis's band, you got Chick Corea, you got Tony Williams. Tony Williams is from Roxbury. Chick Corea is from Massachusetts. Came and lived in Boston and Roxbury. Whenever Miles Davis went on tour, when he wanted to get the real and he wanted to perform and he wanted to be around real people and experience shit, he came to Boston. When he came back, his comeback shows at the Kix Club right in this neighborhood back in 1981, he brought his woman with him, Cicely Tyson, introduced him to all his Boston boys and all his Boston people. Brought her right with him. And this is the first place he came because this is where he felt home aside from New York. There's a fucking reason for that. But the thing is that, again, as I say this, walking back and forth in the apartment Ron McNair lived in when he went to MIT. But if I went on Wikipedia, I couldn't find any mention of it until after I wrote that article for OK Player. And then all of a sudden, bam, it's there. When I went on Twitter and made a rant talking about the Rainbow Coalition and how they don't talk about there's a Rainbow Coalition office in Boston, when it's one of the first offices in Boston because of the contributions of Mel King, all of a sudden I go to Wikipedia, bam, it's there. So me being loud and talking and shutting motherfuckers down has literally changed some things. Not enough, not fast enough. Because everywhere I look, there's always some mediocre white folks who are given the task of representing Boston, even though they don't deserve it. Whether it be Bill Simmons, whether it be that asshole that runs Barstool Sports. This is the face of Boston. When Maria Menounos popped up, all of a sudden, bam, she's the it girl of Boston. When Uzo Aduba and Diane Guerrero showed up on Orange is the New Black, they still didn't get that same distinction. And that show was a breakout hit for years. Why is that? When Mindy Kaling came out, I knew Mindy Kaling back when she was going to school with my cousin, Denora. Okay? And then all of a sudden I see her on a Conan O'Brien show talk as a writer, and she's talking about she pitched a show called The Mindy and Something Show with her and her best friend. And when she tested for it, they told her she wasn't right for the show that she created. So later on, she creates her own show, The Mindy Project. And on The Mindy Project, in like a late episode, it comes out that Mindy's from a town in Massachusetts. And her brother comes to visit. And her brother is played by UTK from fucking Freestyle Love Supreme. And I'm like, what? And she asks, so how's small town in Massachusetts? And then he says, and then they talk nothing about it. Because for her, she doesn't have the burden of representing Boston every motherfucking time she speaks because it's not a big deal for her. But Boston is automatically stamped on the other people on The Office. When the Bruins played the fucking St. Louis Blues, it was Pam versus Jim. I think, you know, because one's from St. Louis, the other one's from Massachusetts, not necessarily Boston. I'm from Boston. And that's the face of Boston every time. The face of Boston is always white. I love Chris Evans, but the face of Boston is always white. Moreover, one of my favorite Marvel heroes of all time is Cloak from Cloak and Dagger. Why? Because Cloak, I believe it was introduced in 82 or 83, is a Bostonian, a Black Bostonian. However, he was created by a white person from New York. So the story is that he was from South Boston. What black kid was living in South Boston in the fucking early 80s? Now, he was likely from the south end of Boston like me. That shit never got corrected. Never. Matter of fact, there was a later issue written where Cloak could become corporeal now, meaning he could be like a body. He wasn't like a black mass of darkness. So he could become corporeal now. And he's hanging out in his neighborhood in South Boston with a bunch of brown people on the corner. And it's talking about, yo, man, things are different in the Southie now. Who the fuck calls it the Southie? Nobody. Because it was written by a motherfucker who doesn't live here and never has. I remember the episode of The Simpsons where they were referring to people as a Southie. That's not a fucking thing. But again, the Black and Latino experience in Boston doesn't exist. When you look at any type of media that involves us, we're not there. The one show that was dedicated to the brown experience in Boston was, it needed LeBron James and Maverick Carter to produce, and it was written by a white comedian guy from Boston. And the show was set in Dorchester, and it was called Survivor's Remorse. Got better every season, got canceled by Stars. 3 seasons on Stars. I wish I had the entire fucking collection. I put it on a flash drive and just watch it because it was that good. I loved it. And it was the only representation of black people from my city that I got to see that was standout great, should have won a million awards. But guess what? These black people from Boston, from Dorchester, had to be in Atlanta in order for that show to work. They couldn't be in Boston. They traveled back and forth to Boston all the motherfucking time. The anger, the resistance, the quickness of black Bostonians, all there. How black Bostonians deal with white Bostonians of different ethnic groups, all there. I want to see more of that shit. But after that show's 3 years is up, bam, nothing. Nothing. And also, when they did a Cloak and Dagger show, they moved it to New Orleans. So bam, that's the erasure. No more black Bostonian Marvel heroes. Anytime we get any chance or any shot for a possible representation of black Boston, doesn't happen. City on a Hill. The show stars one of my favorite actors, Aldous Hodge. Aldous Hodge plays a black dude from somewhere else who wants to tear down all the fucking racist machinations of Boston. Motherfucker, nobody wants to do that more than a black person or a Latino person who grew up in Boston their entire lives. Why couldn't he be a fucking black or Latino Bostonian in that role? No, it was always someone from somewhere else. And then they always drop the fucking ball on certain things, like they go to Bromley Heath, there's 2 white guys in an apartment. What the fuck is that? What is that? It's always something. Fringe. They go to Roxbury, to a warehouse in Roxbury. There's nothing but white people there. West Roxbury? They did a show called, it was the show with the 2 white women who were detectives. And it was homie who was the famous Jet Jackson, Lee Thompson Young, I think, and he had committed suicide. He was working on that show. They did a show about Cape Verdeans. I cannot remember the name of the show for the life of me. It was 2 white women were the head of it. They did a show on Cape Verdeans. They completely fucked it up. Boston Public. A show about a Boston public school. I've never seen this many white kids in a Boston public school that wasn't Boston Latin or Boston Academy. Those are exam schools. Boston public schools don't have white kids in them. They just don't. They make up about 10% of the population now. Okay? I could just run down the list of all these Boston shows. Fever Pitch. This guy teaches in a Boston public school. I'm like, where are all the brown kids? This school doesn't exist. Anyways, what I'm saying is that the black and Latino experience in Boston is a race, and what ends up happening is the byproduct is that we get shit on by our own people nationwide because they think we don't exist. And kids growing up think we don't exist because they never see themselves represented anywhere. And I had to step up and change things. And hopefully somebody picks up the fucking mantle and does it even better than I did. And hopefully we finally break through. Because this shit is unacceptable. One.